Promontory.
So thank you for the invite and the conference and the sun so far. Today I'm going to talk about some directions of thinking that have been done by Ken Van Tilburg, a postdoc at MIU, and Anna Maria Taki, a student of mine. The overarching idea of this conference is, you know, is there some sort of paradigm shift which is coming to the fore? And very often paradigm shifts, they can come from new theoretical ideas, but they can also come from new sets of data. And one of the great new sets of data that is, of course, in our face, especially over the last week, is the incredible new astrometric data that we're getting most recently from Gaia. And so an important question that we can ask is, how can this be used to help advance our understandings of dark matter? So when people give colloquia, we've all heard 1,000 colloquia on dark matter. People like to start off with the picture of a Swicky, you know, spherical bastards. But you can actually start before that. You can start with Le Verrier. Le Verrier was the person who mathematically discovered Neptune by looking at the orbits of Uranus, calculating that there should be some perturbing object, suggesting to astronomer colleagues to go look for it. They did, and it was found a few weeks later. And the reason why I think this is an interesting way to place to start with the history of dark matter is because we think about the evidence for dark matter being in these, you know, very order one effects on the CMB or in terms of the motions of stars or galaxies, but there's also very, very precise measurements that can be used to infer the properties of dark matter as well, and that's the direction I'm going to go today. I don't think I have to convince anybody here about the importance of doing gravitational-only searches for dark matter. The ones we've heard about from accelerators or direct detection experiments are, of course, great in revealing the particle nature of dark matter, but a lot of the information we have, maybe all the information we have right now, is coming from its couplings and interactions gravitationally. We know it's coupling to gravity, and we can get a lot of constraints already on what it is and what it's not, in terms of we know it's not relativistic, we know that it's not strongly interacting, at least appropriately qualified. And so because the universe has been around for so long and it has so many scales, there's really a lot of opportunities to probe many, many different types of models using gravitational-only dynamics. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm going to be talking about looking for dark matter objects. They're ultimately going to be compact objects or very traditional NFW-like halos using astrometric searches. But within that general type of things that you're looking for, there's a huge range of physics and dark matter models that can be tested. Obviously, I'll specifically talk about NFW halos. Questions you can ask as you look at smaller and smaller scales are, is there a cutoff in the power spectrum, the fundamental power spectrum for dark matter, below which we don't see any subhalos? Is there some scale dependence that could tell us about inflation? If you talk about compact objects, you can, of course, talk about primordial black holes, but they don't have to be black holes. You can have clumps of dark matter that maybe didn't coalesce enough into being a black hole, but are still compact enough to give you black hole light signals. If you have dark matter like axions, there can be fluctuations in the early universe that are isocurvature that wouldn't be picked up in a lot of other ways, but can ultimately collapse and give you very, very dense halos of, for instance, of bosonic material. You can have dissipative dark matter dynamics, which will allow systems to cool and make very, very dense halos. This is just a list, but the point is that there are a lot of different mechanisms that allow dark matter to condense. There's, of course, the ordinary spherical collapse, but there are a lot of different ways that dark matter can condense from its primordial properties, from its dissipative dynamics, or its attractive properties that allow us to think about a range of masses and scales of compact dark matter objects. Something that Tim mentioned in his talk when he was talking about supersymmetry was, he said, well, this is pushing the boundary of good taste. And as we're talking about the types of dark matter models that we might think about, I think it's worth marking that we already have a theory that is pushing the boundaries of good taste, namely the standard model. We like to line things up in a fashion like this where it looks very nice and pretty. But we all know that it's full of a huge number of unexplained parameters. We don't understand the origin of the baryonic symmetry of the universe. We don't understand the primordial perturbations. There's a lot going on, even forgetting about the aesthetic issues associated with the Higgs boson. So I think that it's very, very worthwhile to step back and just say, well, what kinds of gravitational searches can we do? And then we can figure out what sorts of things they can constrain later. So what's changing? Why is now a good time to have this sort of a talk or this sort of an exercise? If you were not under a scientific rock in the last week. You were inundated by tweets and articles and blog posts about Gaia. It's an optical space-based mission that will, over the course of several years, achieve an astrometric precision on the locations of stars in the sky of order of 100 microarcseconds. That's extremely precise. That gives you the ability to measure parallax distances to stars inside of our galaxy, as well as their proper motions as they move across the sky. And so that's the idea of astrometry, the ability to measure the positions and motions of visible objects that we hope to use for holometry to measure the properties of the dark objects inside the Milky Way. In the future, hopefully there'll be a mission Theia, which will be a follow-up. You can think of it as like Gaia, but extreme, where sensitivity on general objects can improve by a factor of 10. On objects where they spend a lot of time on it, they can improve by a factor of 100. And then there's the Square Kilometer Array, which is a radio telescope that will measure between 10 to 7, 10 to the 8 quasars with accuracies of up to about 10 microarcseconds. So the point of this slide is just to emphasize that right now is a really a critical moment where we're getting just inundated by new astrometric data, and we should be thinking about what we can do with it. But this flood of data that we're getting today is not going to be the end of it. It's going to continue into the future. So what is it that I'm going to be talking about? The general idea is to talk about weak lensing inside the Milky Way, of dark matter inside the Milky Way, of stars. Okay? This is not going to be photometric lensing, where things get brighter or fainter as dark matter transits in front of the star. It's going to be astrometric microlensing. So the location of a star is going to change because of the presence of a dark object that's between us and the star. And that's the general idea, and we're going to look at that in all sorts of different ways to try to find out what sorts of sensitivities we have. But that's the basic basic direction. You can sit down and calculate the typical shift that you might get of a star inside the Milky Way from the presence of some sort of dark object. So here, you can calculate this, angular shift, which is just 4gm over b. If here is the observer, and here is some luminous source, and here is some dark object between you and that source, there's some impact parameter between the line of sight and the dark object, so some close point of closest approach between the line of sight and the dark object. And the ratio between the mass and that impact parameter basically tells you how much deflection you get. So more massive objects give you a bigger deflection, and closer approaches give you a bigger deflection. This is all things we learned in GR. The overall size of it, if you plug in sort of a 10 to the 6 solar mass object, maybe some pretty biggish subhalo that's inside the Milky Way, with an impact parameter, which is sort of a characteristic, you know, average distance scale inside the Milky Way of 10 kiloparsecs, you'll get a deflection angle of about 4 microarcseconds. Now, 4 microarcseconds is maybe below the size that you might hope to get inside of with the precision with Gaia, but it's not crazy far off. And so this might give you some hope, except for that this deflection on average is not directly observable. You don't know where a star is, and so if the star would have been there and now it's over there by a few microarcseconds, who cares, right? You can calculate this, and this leads to effectively a change of density of stars that you're looking at by about 10 to the minus 10. And of course, you have fluctuations in real density within the Milky Way of levels that are much higher than that. So if all you wanted to do was go out and say, I'm going to stick various dark lenses and hope that I'm going to see more or less stars in different spots of the sky, that would not be very fruitful. However, we are not just looking at a snapshot of the sky. We are doing this in the time domain. We get to see many, many different images of objects, and you can take advantage of that. And so we are not the first people to make this observation. This observation goes all the way back to 1999. Probably the sort of critical paper on this was Belikarov and Evans in 2002, who looked at this for looking for dark objects in the Milky Way. Arachek and Lee followed up by looking at ultra-compact mini-halos. But the idea is pretty simple. Imagine that you have a star which is moving across the sky in front of you, and imagine that it transits some distance delta b. Okay, so the impact parameter is going to change by amount delta b. Let's suppose that that change in the impact parameter is comparable to the impact parameter. Well, that means that the lensing angle that you would have had is changing by order 1. So what you'll actually see, if here is the dark object moving across, so let's imagine for this second that we're going to go to the frame where the star is just sitting still. So imagine the star is just sitting here and a dark object comes past it. As this dark object comes past it, the star is going to do a little dance. It's going to move in a little circle as it moves around, and then it's going to come back to where it started out. And that is something that you can look for. Even if the overall deflection is not something you can look for, this motion is something you can look for and you can get constraints on. Now, of course, what you actually see is you'll see a star moving across the sky. It's not going to be sitting there. You're going to see a star moving across the sky, and it's going to do a little blip, which is why we call it a blip. But that's what you can look for. Okay, that's the basic object you can look for in the time domain. Objects move roughly at about 10 to the minus 3 C. So if you want the impact parameter to change by an order one amount, then you need this star to come within about 10 to the minus 3 parsecs of the line of sight of the dark object, which is very close. Okay, so this is a rare phenomenon that can happen, but it is a real phenomenon that can happen. But only relatively light solar mass-ish objects can have these sorts of close encounters. So these people have all studied this a great deal. There are, I think, some extensions one can do, but this qualitative observation has been made before. So then the next question that you can ask is, well, what happens if you go into the regime where the change in impact parameter is not so large, where the change in impact parameter is actually relatively small? So if you want to think about it this way, before we were talking about a dark object and a star moving like that, here you can think of it as a dark object and a star moving like this. Okay, so a very small change in the overall relative size of the lens, in effect. Well, if that's true, well, we know how to do calculus, so we can go into the instantaneous approximation and calculate some derivatives. You can calculate the effective change in the lensing angle with one and two derivatives. You basically just pick up this factor of the velocity of the lens versus the impact parameter. But this now gives you a different set of observables you can look for, right? So instead of looking for a blip that you watch in the time domain, you can look for effects on the velocities or accelerations of the luminous objects that exist in the halo. So these are the templates, just to show you that we can make mathematical plots. If you stick a lens in the middle, and you ask what's going to be the effect on stars around it, on luminous sources. So this is the effect on position. It's just some outward lensing, the usual lensing. In terms of velocity, there's something that looks like a dipole-ish pattern. This is actually for an extended object, specifically an extended NFW halo. But there's some sort of dipole-ish pattern outside and some approximately uniform motion inside. And it's more complicated for acceleration. I'll come back to those templates and what those things look like when they're relevant, but just to show that you can actually go out and calculate what kinds of effects you should have. What's important isn't just the precision that you're getting with Gaia data. What's important is that you're getting a huge number of sources. And new things are possible when you have a billion stars that you look at precisely. Two basic categories are, one, rare objects. Okay. If you have many, 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 many stars, then extremely unlikely things can occur and will occur. The other thing that you can do, and I'll discuss these, everything I've listed in specific slides, the other thing you can do is instead of looking at the effect on one star, you can try and aggregate many stars together where each individual star would have had an effect which is unobservable, but together they give you some sort of statistically significant signal that you can then look for. So, let me give you some examples. Start with rare objects. So, in the presence of many, many objects, close encounters become possible, even likely. Let's consider this situation I was talking about before, which we call an outlier. Let's suppose that there is a fairly sizable separation between a dark object and a star. Okay? So, this black arrow here indicates how far the dark halo is actually moving. It may not be enough of a motion to induce this blip effect, but if the approach is close enough, it can give an apparent velocity to the star, right? So if you think about it, as this dark object moves, the star is going to move, and that alone could be very, very interesting. For instance, what if the lens velocity that you saw was, just to pick a crazy number, 20,000 kilometers per second? If you saw a star going 20,000 kilometers per second, especially if it was strictly in its proper motion and not at all in its radial motion, that would be something very, very striking. Okay? So that's something you can go look for. If you do go into this regime where delta B over B is comparable to 1, then as the dark object moves past a star, you'll see it do a little dance, and you can go out and you can look for those dances. The only problem with this is that the current data set of Gaia is not actually giving us the full time series information, so this is not an analysis that you can do today. The other problem with it is it's not repeatable. The dark object goes past, and you've had your deviation from a straight line path, and then who knows what to do after that.
When you say you can't do it, you mean the Gaia team can do it, but you sitting outside?
So I cannot do it. And I will repeat something that I have only on the authority of having talked to David Hogg about this, which is to say that the Gaia team is not doing anything in terms of publications with their data that cannot be done by people outside the collaboration. So, no, I can't do it without the full-time series data, but if that is true, then they also will not be doing it. So they're not going to do a secret analysis and release it, although I'd be totally psyched if they did. But apparently, the way they're operating is that everybody gets to play by the same data set, ultimately.
But they have the data.
So they have the data. Yeah. And my understanding is that as time goes on, they're going to give more and more raw data and hopefully ultimately get to this point. So it's not at all unreasonable. This is not like some sort of, you know, a situation where we think that they were at odds. I think that ultimately they would like to put this out. But even with DR2, you can go and there's a lot of things to be understood just at the data product level in DR2. So, you know, this we don't want to jump the gun. There are a lot of things to work through. The next thing that you can look for is a multi-object observable, which in this particular object is a multi-blip. So if a star, if a dark object can come by and traverse one star and have it do a little motion, then it's also possible that a dark object can come past two or more stars, and then you have correlated motions like this. This is also a rare object, but it's an object where you can add up the statistical significances of multiple stars. So maybe each individual star would not be compelling that you saw that much of a deviation from a straight line path, but if I saw four such stars in a row, that would be a much more significant event. Multi-object observables can become even more interesting. As I said before, if I have an NFW halo or any sort of extended dark matter distribution, as it's moving along in space, what I can expect to see happen is it's going to give me some overall expectation of effective velocities. Okay, so if I have many, many stars in the background and I have an NFW halo that's moving in front of them, then what's going to happen is I'm going to see all of those stars have pick up an effective motion, but an effective motion which is going to be very, very, very predicted based on the properties of the lens that's moving behind it. So rather than looking for any individual star moving like that, I can look for many, many stars. I can look for 1,000 stars that all together point to this sort of dipole-ish pattern around the dark object. And this is something that you can do with the current data set. And then the last example of an observable that we've thought about are correlations. So this is more akin to a two-point function on the whole sky. What you can essentially do is go out and look at a star and see if there's other stars that are near it and ask, are the velocities or accelerations of those stars correlated with each other more than they would be with just random noise? This obviously has all sorts of problems because there are real correlations in the data, but they can be worked through. So these are the basic observables that we've thought about. Outliers, objects whose velocities or accelerations are sufficiently high that you can use them as a probe of the existence of dark objects that are lensing them. Blips, where a dark object traverses past a visible object and you see a motion which deviates strongly from straight line. Multi-blip, when you see that from multiple objects. Templates, where you see 1,000 objects or so, which have together the statistical significance to tell you that there is a dark object behind them. And correlations, where you add up the correlations over the entire sky or the entire field of view to try to convince yourself that there is some effect that needs to be explained by dark matter. There are a lot of different sources you can use to do this. Within Gaia, of course, you have a tremendous set of stars. They're disk stars. They're very bright. They can be accurately measured, but they're very close, and they have a lot of intrinsic noise. The noise you have to worry about is not just how well you can measure these things, but how much they're actually moving on their own, and close stars are moving quite a bit. You can look at the large and small Magellanic clouds, which are far enough away that the objects in them have low intrinsic noise. They're not moving a lot in terms of their angular motion, but they're not measured very well, and even the parallax to them is not well constrained. The dream objects to use asymptotically are quasars, because they're uncorrelated with each other. They're very, very stable. Unfortunately, there are not as many of them in the current data set, but we hope that there'll be more as time goes on. So let me start with a brief discussion in looking for small, compact objects. Oh, yeah? Just one? So blips and multi-blips. So blips and multi-blips, just to show that we're serious, we have what's effectively a matched filter that we use. So you weight each observation by its noise, and you have some expectation of how much lensing you would expect to have. You take the dot product of that with the actual motion of a star, and you see what sorts of residual you get. Outliers, you go out and you calculate the size of the effect that you observe, and you compare that to the noise in question. That noise can be the observational noise in the case of acceleration. It can be the intrinsic noise in the motions of the stars for the case of velocities. And if you combine those, this is what we believe your sensitivity looks like for compact objects. And I'll take you through what the different lines are. So here, this is for the masses of objects versus solar mass. And this is the F, this is the fraction of the dark matter density versus the total dark matter density. So this down here is 10 to the minus 7 of the dark matter density. And this is sensitivity, but for instance, in the case of blips and monoblips and multi-blips, you also have to start worrying about, you know, once you're down to this level of sensitivity, you're also going to start running into actual non-visible stars that are just below your observational threshold that are moving across there. But leaving that aside, this is the overall sensitivity that you should be able to reach. So the solid lines are what we believe you should be able to do with the Gaia data. The dashed lines are what we believe you should do with a Theia-like mission. So monoblips, so that is just looking for a star getting deflected, should be able to give you sensitivity down in sort of solar mass-ish range, is well below what you can do with a lot of current observations. Accelerations, so looking for outlier accelerations, looking for the fact that these things have been given an induced acceleration, which is very high, we think can give you quite a bit of sensitivity down here, and we do have hope that the Gaia team will be releasing fitted accelerations in the not-too-distant future. And outlier velocity is not as sensitive, but it's probably something that we can do relatively soon. But this is the sensitivity that we think that we should be able to get with the data that's available in the future. Templates is a more complicated story because it really involves going out and looking at a large ensemble of stars. You want a high density of stars to do this. It's, again, a matched filter. You basically calculate what you think the object should give you, and you dot product that in with the stars that you observe. Correlations, you can do a very similar thing. You basically take nearby stars, you dot product their velocities or accelerations into each other, weighted by their noise, and then you take some sort of some window function that tells you how close you're willing to take these things. And this is what we think the sensitivity is for upcoming data sets. So this is for NFW-like subhalos. This is the scale radius in parsecs along the y-axis, and the mass of this more or less core region, the lensing region, along the x-axis. Solid lines are things that we think that you can do in the near term with existing data sets, and the dashed lines are what we think you can do with future data sets. So green lines are correlated velocity, red is correlated acceleration, blue is this template velocity. And these dark lines here are standard NFW halos. for different levels of concentration depending on where they are inside the Milky Way. And these dashed lines are the kinds of halos you would get if they had collapsed earlier in the universe. And I think the thing to note is that you can probe interesting regions of parameter space even with the upcoming data, the current data, but the future data, if it comes to realize, is going to really probe down into a very interesting region of parameter space. You can plot this in a slightly different way, which is in terms of primordial perturbations. So this is the power spectrum, the curvature power spectrum, and then the allowed range based on existing observations. And here are all those lines that I just showed you, but plotted versus scale factor and the power spectrum on the y-axis. And the reason why I show this is to make a point. One way that you can get these sorts of enhanced dark objects at small scales is if there's some increased power at small scales from inflation that then collapsed earlier. And even within, you don't have to go crazy, you don't have to come up with all sorts of crazy models, even within the sort of like one sigma band of uncertainty within the Planck results for the power spectrum, for the scale of the primordial curvature perturbations, if you extend that down to small scales, within that one sigma band, you're getting probed by these observations. So you don't have to imagine that, well, of course, if you cross down here, this line down here is just looking at very, very ordinary objects. But even at these small scales, these sorts of tests can rule out currently unprobed regions of parameter space. There are a lot of things to worry about. I'm sure we can discuss them. but let me transition to a coda. There's one more type of dark matter, which of course was where we started with, which was what Le Verrier was looking for, which were planets. And people are interested in whether there could be objects beyond the Kuiper belt, and they're very, very hard to see because reflected light drops off like d to the fourth, whereas their infrared emission drops like d squared, and it's very hard to do a long exposure because these things move across the sky quite a bit. And if there's one thing that I've learned over the last years of listening to exoplanet talks is that the data definitely got ahead of the theory in terms of exoplanets. And so who knows what's out there, right? Who knows what's out there? But in particular, people have made arguments that there could be some sort of Planet 9 out there. There are correlations in the properties of Kuiper belt objects and in their orbits that make some arguments that there should be some ninth planet with a mass around 10 Earth masses orbiting at around, say, 1,000 astronomical units. And this is very, very, very hard to find because it's so far away. It doesn't emit a lot of light. It may be inside the disk of the galaxy in terms of its line of sight, and so it could be very hard to see against background stars. But this is a perfect possibility for using this multi-blip technique. So as a planet would traverse past various stars, and actually what happens is not that it traverses, its motion is relatively small, but as the parallax motion, as we go around the sun, that Planet 9 would appear to more or less go back and forth in front of a field of stars, and you can calculate how many stars would have a sort of change, a multi-blip effect on it, and for sort of characteristic typical regions of the sky at a distance of 1,000 AU, you'd expect to see about 400 stars have an effect. For a 10 solar mass star being blipped at about one astronomical unit, that effect is a quarter of a micro arc second. Closer ones would give you a bigger effect. But altogether, you can calculate the effective signal noise and make a plot as to what you think you could do, and this is what we think it looks like. So again, solid lines are what you can do with Gaia, dashed lines are what we think you could do with Theia. This is if it happens to be in a region of high stellar density. These are ordinary planets. We believe they've already been corrected for in the data set, but that's another discussion. But the key point is that we believe that with the full Gaia data and the full time series data, you can actually go out and find a Planet 9 if it's out there. In the near future, the Gaia data is out. It's a real data set. It's not like these sorts of things that I've been doing. Parallaxes still are all over the places. There are all sorts of noise that need to be understood. If you've downloaded the data and started playing with it, you know what I'm talking about. But I believe in the near term, these two studies will be doable, and we intend to do them. And if you can do them, we expect you can do them better than we can. Let me conclude. We're talking about what can change dramatically, and I think that time domain astrometry gives a lot of new opportunities. We've just started thinking about this. I think that probably what we've thought about is not the best thing that you can do. I'm sure there are a lot of ideas that are better than we've come up with, that you could come up with. But there are very simple observables that we can start talking about. Monoblips, high velocity things, high acceleration things, or multi-object things, which are more complicated. But altogether, they're going to give us some sensitivity into a lot of objects that would be otherwise very hard to see, like maybe Planet 9. So I'll stop there.
Okay, questions?
Hi, it's a nice talk. So I have two questions. One is in the expected sensitivity plane, is that, for dark matter, primordial object with that, with those features, you definitely expect to see that. And so if you don't see that, you can make limits?
This plot.
And mass versus fraction. This one, yeah.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
So this would give limits? This would be a new way of setting limits, is that right?
This would be a new way. So
if you don't see it.
So for instance, these lines here were done under the sensitivity of 10 sigma, which we chose as a threshold, which would be like if you saw something like that, you probably wouldn't be like, oh, I know for sure I've seen a dark object, but you would start getting excited about it, right? So so those are on that level of excitement. So if you lower your standards, you can possibly do better limits than these. This is sort of like discovery-ish. For the blips, it's more complicated because at some level in here, for sure, you expect to start seeing blips from ordinary non-luminous compact objects. And then you have to start asking other questions like, maybe start, for instance, looking at the LMC. So you believe that, you have a higher density of dark objects between you and there. And comparing, actually using the parallaxes of where you're seeing these blips occurring. So if you're seeing all of your blips occurring, in the disk, and you don't see any occurring in halo stars, then that would be so. So this is under the assumption that there's the question of if there are dark objects with this fraction and this mass, then you should see this effect. Okay. If you don't see this effect, then you can definitely set limits. But I bet before you get down here, you're going to start running into things that you need to worry about, and then the story becomes more complicated. This is really the beginning of this discussion, I think.
And then.
Proper motions of the stars.
What's that?
Includes the actual velocities of the stars in this disk or halo.
In this, yeah.
It is included.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's in most cases that's the dominant source of noise. Yeah. The intrinsic motions of the stars is much larger than the. I mean, by design, right? That you actually want to measure their motion, so you have a angular resolution which is better than that. So in most cases, the noise is coming from the actual stellar motions themselves.
And then the second question was for the outlier velocity acceleration. That's for, in principle, you have a you need to be measuring that over some amount of time. Is that assuming that those things are like that's the total distance in between whichever Gaia data releases come out, or
so, how exactly do you correlate? So the Gaia mission has a cadence over which it observes every object. And so over the course of the full 5-year mission, you expect to get about 70 observations of any individual object. And the velocity that they give us, the proper motion that they give us, comes about from an astrometric fit to that full data set. Right now, for instance, what you can get when they give that to you is they'll give you the parallax, the position, the proper motion, but they'll also give you things like whether the noise properties of it are ordinary or not ordinary. And then as time goes on, they'll get better. The parallax will become more accurate, the proper motion measurements will become more accurate. But Okay. So for outlier velocities, so let me be very clear about the different observables. When I talk about outlier velocities, I'm really talking about a situation where there's no blip, okay, where the star is here, and the dark object is here, and the average motion is like that, okay? So the overall impact parameter is not changing by order one. But if this is a massive enough object, then it could have lensed it over to here, okay? So then as it's moving here, then this is slowly coming back into its ordinary position, and that motion, that apparent motion as it comes back into its unlensed position will be interpreted by us as a proper motion. And that could be very high, and we can use that to set limits. And in that situation, you're just asking how fast are these objects moving and trying to weight those by objects that have a lot of dark matter between us and them. If you're talking about these monoblip situations, then what you would see right now is you'd see an object that probably has a pretty bad chi-squared, and then as time goes on, the chi-squared per degree of freedom would start getting better because that blip would have already occurred, and it will start diluting it out. But if you had the full time series data, then you could go back and you would look at it and you would see it.
Over there.
So it seems like a lot of the contexts that you're thinking about this in are sort of discrete halo searches, but it seems like in theory you could make a full two-point correlation function where you have the matter, you have the power spectrum of these fluctuations. And I think part of the thing that Keith and I have been talking about this, but part of the thing that's like very appealing about these correlation analyses are they would use a lot of the fundamental tools that are being developed for weak lensing analyses right now, for you know weak lensing shear analyses. So like the cosmologists have been doing things like this and phrasing it in, you know, in a way that they understand could get them very excited in trying to do these kinds of things.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. We started with the template analyses because that was something that we could understand. We started thinking about trying to do these sorts of two-point functions, but or general power spectrum. But we actually started running into questions about like how you properly do the analysis when you're not sampling it, and it's a very, very hard but interesting question. But it seemed hard enough that it was probably okay. That's something that's has a lot of work that's associated with it. So as I'm saying, I think that this is not at all necessarily the optimal set of things that you can think about.
Yeah, there. So it seems to me that the obvious target first for these would be the dwarf galaxies that are currently around the Milky Way. Have you thought about using, like, you know, even the 10, 20, 30 systems that we know of?
Yeah, so I have, and I have made a plots for those. Those, if you go back to this plot, okay, so they all kind of are like over here, right? In terms of this is solar mass, so there's 10 to the 9 solar masses, they're kind of like over there, assuming that they're sort of like standard NFWE. So I would not expect them to be visible with Gaia data. If I do this template analysis, at least the way we're doing it, it's not infinitely far off, but my guess would be it shouldn't be sensitive. On the other hand, with quasars, it absolutely should be. So if you get a good data set of quasars that are accurately measured, I mean, you can see that these things are this blue line, which would be the template one, is well more sensitive than these things. So yes, you should be able to see the LMC, you should be able to see some of the other dwarfs. Maybe you could see even halos of objects outside the galaxy, like see the halo of Andromeda, which is pretty big in angular size. There's other things, like for instance, Tim, where's Tim? Tim, where, oh, no, not you, Tim. Tim Linden here. Oh, he and Dan. Oh, you were on this paper about this additional this point source that might be real with Dan. Anyway, there are claims that, you know, there are unresolved point sources in the Fermi data, right? That might be coming from dark matter, and so you can also look at those and see if you could see a lensing signal. But I don't think you can see those with the Gaia data. But maybe somebody who's smarter could see them with the Gaia data.
More questions? So I've got a quick technical one. What have you assumed about the scaling of concentration with mass in that figure?
This we assume It's a very slow logarithmic evolution that just comes from the original collapse time. There's a reference that I can give you.
So it's not steep power law with mass.
No. Okay. No. No. It's a pretty gradual logarithmic evolution. And then these different lines just correspond to exactly where this object is inside of Milky Way in terms of the tidal stripping.
So any more questions for Neil? So let's thank him and all of this afternoon's speakers again. So now on the schedule, we've got more time for discussion. So is there anything anyone would like to discuss that's been raised by this afternoon's talks or things we didn't have a chance to discuss this morning? Anyone? Yes.
I'll just say this is kind of a general comment, but motivated by the last talk. I think this is definitely the way that we should be thinking as a community in terms of thinking about some of these time domain lensing signatures. And I think it would be helpful. I don't know the answer. I don't know if anyone actually knows the answer. But thinking about if we could actually design an experiment that was optimized towards finding dark matter halos that are, you know, at the scale of ultrafaint galaxies and smaller, where maybe you don't even have stars. I mean, I don't know that we actually know exactly what we would request to build at this point. And I think it would be really helpful, like as a goal of sort of this workshop. You know, so not only this week, but also like for the other, you know, for the participants that are staying longer, I think it'd be a really interesting exercise to make a quantitative comparison of some of the different probes that have been discussed and actually think about what type of experiment we would design. And I think this astrometric, some of these astrometric signatures is definitely one of the types of observables that we would, I think, would be good to include in that type of discussion.
Yeah, has anyone got anything they'd like to input at this point? Yeah.
Well, we have one, which is, I mean, we had one in the pipeline, which is TIA.
Right.
And the problem with this one was, I mean, like every mission is funding. So this was a European mission, and we had some competition from a previous mission for internal politics. I mean, it's quite complicated. But essentially, this is the kind of mission we need. And what we need is a support from the rest of the community. So I would be very happy. I mean, we have a paper on the archive, but I would be very happy to discuss it further. But we need to straighten the case. So for example, what Neil has shown is better than the analysis we had in the proposal. If we make the point, I mean, if all the science cases we had are straightened, that would help. So.
All right. I think Keith's point about using and Neil's talk were generally launching us into this discussion of time domain type probes is great. One thing that I personally didn't fully appreciate until relatively recently is thinking about W first as a dark matter mission, not just as a dark energy and exoplanet mission. So W first is like having a mega, mega HST, if you want to think about it that way. So if you're thinking about proper motions or anything that you might want to do with HST, but with way, way, way more area, that's something to start thinking about now. And think about what sort of GEO programs you might design for that. And high latitude survey strategy.
Yeah, so I think just to get on the bandwagon, I think that a lot of the missions that are being proposed now from sort of a fundamental physics standpoint are relying heavily on dark energy, and it's completely possible that over the next 5 to 10 years, the dark energy case may become less attractive rather than more attractive. And having this alternative fundamental physics case to complement dark energy may be necessary for actually pushing missions like WFIRST, missions like some kind of spectroscopic follow-up to DESI forward. And so building the community of people that are, you know, trying to get real fundamental physics out of these astrophysical observables is super important.
Anyone else? No? Okay, well, I guess everyone wants to enjoy the sunshine, so let's wrap it up for today.